The angle that we often take when we're at these conferences and we're at the Berkman Center and we're thinking about copyright and intellectual property is we're thinking of it often as consumers of that art. And I'm thinking that here we might start to hear a little bit more about what the angle is from the other side of that cube about the creators. And you know, one of the sort of theses here is that technology is enabling creators to create entirely new genres or new forms or reach new audiences, and we know this is basically a given, and I think we've just been seeing how that's demonstrated. It's changed completely the means of production, the ability to now just sort of grab these things and mix them together, whether it's in music, whether it's video, and other forms of art, is completely within our grasp. I've been proselytizing recently about GarageBand, the simple Mac program that's now coming installed on everything. It's remarkable. You know, I'm a musician. I've recorded in bands. When Two Ton Shoe did our first record, maybe 1994, we were using 2-inch tape, and it cost us $25,000, and we were in a big studio. I'm recording on GarageBand, mainly for songwriting purposes, but even that actually is a quality enough production to put out on a CD, and it's I'm doing it at home on this computer right here. It's remarkable what we're doing. I'm bringing in live musicians to record directly onto the laptop. It's not all just pre-recorded music. That kind of stuff is within reach, and some of the stuff that I also think has been fascinating about it that emerges from the panels earlier today is not all of it has to be copyrighted music. You know, there are original loops and sounds that you can get, and Apple supplies them with you, and an $89 CD full of drum loops, and instead of using that trademarked or that copyrighted snare drum and shaker that we just heard a little while ago is the subject of an entire mediation between a major label and artists, there are other ones out there you can create originally. So what I thought I'd do first is just, we have a lot of people on this panel and only an hour, and we don't want to stand between you and lunch. So I want to do quick introductions, and then really what I'm hoping to do is that the panelists will start to interact and ask some questions from the audience and just try to get at some of these themes without trying to be too overly structured about it. We have Wendy Seltzer here, Berkman Fellow. Behind a lot of interesting projects, including Chilling Effects, which I think it would be interesting to hear a little bit about, and also now at EFF. We have David Dixon, who is, among other things, a professor of physics. And I'm hoping that has some angle in here. You know, I don't know if you're going to talk about the physics part of it, but who knows? Maybe it'll come in. But more importantly, for these purposes, works with the band Metallica. And is also the webmaster for Metallica, and I wanted
webmaster
to talk.
Webmaster of puppets.
Webmaster of puppets.
Yes,
that makes perfect sense. There's no Beatles then. You have the webmaster of puppets with some Beatles reference too. You got to get in there. Kembru McLeod, right there to his left, is a journalist, activist, artist, and professor. That's a job title I think we all are aspiring to. Exactly that combination of things. At University of Iowa, author of a couple books on intellectual property, and also the proud owner of the trademark of the phrase freedom of expression. And we'll hear a bit about how that came to pass. Then we have, to his left, we have Maria Daniels, who's a professional photographer, oversees new media production for American Experience at WGBH. Is that right? Naomi Novick, hi, we haven't met yet. This is part of I haven't met some of these people yet.
I rolled in at 4 in the morning last night, so.
Gotcha. And we'll have to distribute the mics so that you can actually hear each other. Has been writing fan fiction for more than a decade and is also the founder and organizer of VividCon, annual convention for digital video enthusiasts who create music videos and other short films based on their favorite television shows. And then, of course, Walter McDonough, who's the general counsel and one of the founders of the Future of Music Coalition, and also represents a bunch of bands and is in the thick of it all the time on these issues. I thought, because it's so much fun basically getting to see video and hear music, that actually we'd start with David and have you talk a little bit about Metallica. You know, really just tell the story. I don't know if everybody's familiar with it, and you know, we could hear a little bit about what that actually is.
Right. So I was a professor of physics at Marquette University. I'm at Carroll College now. And I had some friends who were in the music community in Milwaukee. I just moved there. They knew that I was into Beatles covers. And so they lent me this CD that a local band had done for an annual function called Spoof Fest. It's been a tradition in Milwaukee for the last 12 years or so, where local bands get together for a one-off concert and emulate and desecrate their favorite bands, usually bands that are either defunct or well past their prime, in both a tribute and a parody of those bands. And this band who had done Metallica that year in 2001, just for fun, recorded a bunch of Beatles songs as if they were performed by Metallica, hybridizing the music and the lyrics of both bands. So an example of this is a song called "And Justice for All My Loving."
Is this track 7 that you want to hear? I'm going to be, hopefully it's coming through here. Let's see.
Close your eyes and I'll teach you.
I heard this CD, and I immediately thought, this is genius. People outside of Milwaukee have to hear this. I had no idea who these guys were, never met them. So I just remembered the words of Admiral Grace Hopper, who was a computer pioneer and also the first female admiral in the Navy. She said once, if you want to do something, just go ahead and do it, because it's always easier to apologize than to ask permission. So I set up a really simple web page. I ripped the CD to MP3 files, posted it on this simple web page, told a few friends, and thought nothing more of it. It was just, I wanted to share this joke with some friends of mine. Well, they told a few friends, and they told a few friends, and the meme was spreading, and pretty soon I was getting fan emails from Brazil. And the site was getting 300, 400 hits a day consistently, sometimes spiking up to a couple thousand. Keep in mind, the band did not know I had done this. I had never met them. They had no idea. They just had recorded these songs, and that was it as far as they were concerned. Well, about 6 months after I set this site up, I set the site up in December of 2001. About 6 months later, I finally met Tinker, who was the lead singer. He's actually sitting in the audience right there. Just raise your hand.
Hey.
You can talk to him. I finally met Tinker, and I handed him this stack of emails from all over the world that he'd accumulated. Actually, by now, we've gotten fan emails from every continent on Earth, including Antarctica.
Wow.
So, but the hits kept coming. The meme was not dying out. And because of the fan response, the band decided to reform and record a group of new tunes. And we released those on April 1st of last year. And we called it the Gray EP. DJ Danger Mouse kind of scooped us, but that's okay. There's more than one black album. There can be more than one gray album, too. When this CD was released online, and all the songs are freely downloadable. We did not charge for the music at all. I went through my bandwidth allotment for the month by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had to change a new server, and that's how I learned about BitTorrent and using BitTorrent to distribute files over the internet. As of April 1st, our site's had almost 500,000 hits, who knows how many downloads, and our message has always been, please steal our music. Please download it for free. Please burn CDs for your friends. Please don't charge for it. If you hear of anyone charging for it, let us know. And we've had a couple instances where people have burned CDs of Metallica songs and tried to sell them on eBay. The fans have stepped up and sent letters to eBay to let them know that this was happening, and those auctions have been taken down. We did not have to do anything. We have our own metal militia, so to speak. Metal mop top militia, perhaps. So all was good. You know, we were getting lots of fans. The band started to play live shows. We started to sell T-shirts through the site. All the T-shirts, we checked with our lawyers to make sure that we weren't using any infringing artwork and so on. We were very careful about that. The only thing that would be copyright infringing would be the music, and that we were giving away for free. We figured we're safe. Then I got this. Dated February 17th from Sony ATV Music Publishing, notice of willful copyright infringement, saying that such uses of Sony ATV compositions, derivative works, has caused and continues to cause substantial and irreparable injury and is in direct violation of Sony ATV's rights. And there's a list of things that I have to do. One of them is to compensate Sony in an amount to be discussed after I have promptly complied. So, when you receive a letter like this, a nastygram as some people call them, you run through two different kinds of emotions. One is exhilaration. Oh my God, they're going to sue us. This is great. The other one is despair. Oh my God, they're going to sue us. How are we going to pay the rent? We immediately contacted the EFF. They gave us some very good advice. And we contacted Alan Korn as well. He gave us some very good advice. None of them could take on our case at the time because resources are limited, of course. So we weren't sure where we stood, but luckily we had the cavalry coming over the horizon in the form of Lars Ulrich. Metallica had known about Beatallica for a couple years. Various journalists had asked them, you know, have you heard about Beatallica? And they've said, yes, yeah, we think it's great. We think it's funny. They have a very good sense of humor about that. I mean, they're, you know, John Oswald had from Canada had appropriated their works before, and they had no problem with it. In fact, they commissioned a piece from him using pieces of their music. So they had no problem with the derivative works of Metallica. So when Lars found out that we were being threatened with this cease and desist from Sony, who controls the Beatles catalog. Apparently, Michael Jackson leveraged out his ownership, and he doesn't control it anymore, as I understand it. He contacted his webmaster, the webmaster for Metallica.com. The webmaster contacted me and asked, "Lars wants to talk to James Tinker here." About the cease and desist. Can you give me his home phone number? I said, okay. So I gave him Tinker's home phone number. Lars called him the next day at home and asked, what can we do? And eventually, you know, Tinker and Lars have been talking continuously since then, a couple times a week. And Lars said, let's see what I can do about this. And he contacted one of his attorneys, Peter Paterno, to intercede on our behalf with Sony. Because we do have a lawyer in Milwaukee, but he's not an entertainment lawyer. He's mostly a property lawyer. And he has no pull in the entertainment industry at all. So Lars, just out of the goodness of his heart, asked Peter Paterno to intercede and talk to Sony on our behalf. And Paterno convinced Sony that what they're doing was a bad idea. And Sony is not going to pursue legal action against us.
And that's great.
But. This is a big but, and I like big buts, and I cannot lie.
Did you pay for that one?
It doesn't. Sony is not dropping the suit. They're just not pursuing the suit. And they reserve the right, and they have the right, to go after us in the future if they want. As long as we do not provoke them in any way. And what that means, I don't know. Does that mean we can't release new songs on, you know, new Metallica compositions? Would that be provocation? I don't know.
So, in that sense, do you think that part of their reaction was about publicity? I mean, Lars, you know, had a bad run with the Napster publicity and the Metallica stuff. Do you think that they picked up on it and the label went along with it partly because this is something not as a legal matter or sort of a new approach to any of this generally, but in this specific one?
I can only guess at what their motives are.
And so, Wendy, as you know, from EFF, what would be, is there something instructive in this case that you've seen? This would be the kind of a cease and desist letter you'd find on chillingeffects.org. If you haven't been to chillingeffects.org, it's a wonderful resource where people send in these kinds of letters that they get from labels or publishers.
And I did submit it, actually.
Did you check out the site when
Yes.
when you sent it in? That's excellent.
Oh, yes.
And it gets annotated by lawyers, and some of that's explained. But where does this fit into that?
I think that this is a compelling illustration of what we see on chilling effects, which is sort of the upside and downside of new technologies for distribution, that the Beatallica was sort of it sounds like a little local band that wasn't getting much attention beyond the local area until it went up on the internet, and suddenly everyone had access to it, including Sony copyright holders, who suddenly decided that what they might have been able to overlook, if they'd even noticed it while it was a little local phenomenon, they couldn't or wouldn't overlook when it was a nationally distributed set of MP3s. And so suddenly we're seeing clashes between individuals who have hit upon a great technology for distributing their creative endeavors and big corporations, big intellectual property holders who suddenly see all of the little individuals gnawing away at their intellectual property holdings. And they'll send cease and desist letters, some of them well-considered, some of them within their bounds, within the bounds of the law, some of them completely over the top, just on the assumption that because they're big lawyers with big letterheads, they can scare off these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So Chilling Effects collects those and has law students at clinics, including the Berkman Center, annotating them to help people understand what their rights are and what the limits of their rights are. And sometimes the advice that comes out at the end, although Chilling Effects doesn't give legal advice, is what you're doing is legal, keep going. Sometimes it's more what you're doing is okay, but might land you in a lot of legal risk. Keep it off the internet becomes
right.
Some of the unstated recommendations there.
Yeah.
And sometimes because of the issues that have come to light through Chilling Effects, we find copyright holders who have completely gone overboard or claimed copyright holders. I'll just tell a brief example of another case that came through EFF last year of Jib Jab Media. Two brothers, cartoonists, put together a parody of George Bush and John Kerry in the presidential campaign, set to the tune of "This Land Is Your Land." And each of them was slinging insults at one another over verses of "This Land Is Your Land." Great little cartoon. Check it out online at from the Jib Jab Films, if you can. And the estate of Woody Guthrie sent a cease and desist notice claiming that this was an unauthorized use of the Woody Guthrie song. As we, at that time, EFF wasn't quite so pressed with the MGM versus Grokster case that was taking up all of our time at the beginning of this year. And we were able to take on that case. And we found that the song itself had never been properly registered. The copyright hadn't been properly renewed. And so the song was in the public domain. "This land is all of our land." "This song is our song." After we made that fact known, they quickly dropped their complaint.
Move the mic a little.
Yo, yo.
There you go.
And the song wasn't copyrightable, right? Because it was actually I think Michael Harrington did a lot of research on this, that it was actually taken from a Cotta family song. He just took the music of a Cotta family song and put new lyrics to it.
It's Little Darlene Palomine, right?
I'm sorry?
That's the name of the song, Little Darlene Palomine.
Yeah, sorry?
When the World's on Fire.
When the World's on Fire.
That's a
It's incredible. It's the same exact, it's This Land Is Your Land with different words, except it was recorded in what, 1921? Is that right?
So just out of copy, it was out of copyright, you're saying?
It wasn't copyrightable because he'd basically taken us, the song itself was stolen. Not that I dislike Woody Guthrie, for example.
So I want to move on.
So,
go ahead.
So there were lots of questions about the copyright ownership of the song. And the lesson that we try to bring home to would-be copyright claimants and would-be threateners here is sort of be careful how much you reach for, because if you overreach, you can find that you hold a lot less than you think you do.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Naomi, I wanted to ask you to weigh in a bit. So for fan fiction, which I myself don't know a lot about, and I'm hoping you could tell us a bit more about really the whole feel of it, but have you gotten a cease and desist letter like that?
I have not. I mean, I know people who have. And, of course, fan fiction is a little different because being text, you're not copying typically the text of the original source, even if you're writing fan fiction about a book, a literature. You're typically not copying and pasting the way that typically you do. In fact, what I was going to say is probably more applicable is fan vidding. Where typically fans are taking shows like, for instance, Star Trek,
right,
and cutting together clips with popular songs, the kind of thing that the RIAA does get excited about. And really, you know, the trick with fan vidding, you know, this example with the Jib Jab and the Woody Guthrie song, you know, what sort of struck me about the example was it's the reason they can get away with it is because this particular case, when you look at it really closely, this particular song was not theirs, in fact.
Right.
You can't do that on a general sort of basis. For instance, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of fan videos out there. They're using thousands and thousands of, at VividCon, for instance, which is a convention where we show these fan vids, typically, we're showing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of vids over the course of a single weekend, you know, different movies, different shows.
Are the lawyers in the
songs.
Audience for that or
uh-huh.
not really?
You know, it's 100 people, so basically we're flying under the radar.
Uh-huh.
And that's really the effect, that it forces people to stay below the radar, just in general, you know.
Does it force people just to stay below the radar or often to you know, just really diligently make sure they're not incorporating something directly? Like with fan fiction, the text version, you're saying that you can, because it's text and it's more flexible, you can go a bit further and make sure that it's not stealing something directly. When you're trying to use these elements, well-known elements that exist in a copy, in a digital copy, you're sort of forced to use them.
Right, exactly. And it's just, you know, you have to, I mean, for fan videos, that's the source you have. So
what's some fan fiction that you write or that you...
I've written in at least 20 fandoms or so.
Like, give me a couple. Like, what do you like? What?
Master and Commander, Star Trek. Yes, I've done Star Trek.
So you've done a Star Trek. And how long? This is like a little novella that you're writing about this, or
I've
a chapter?
Written anything from, you know, 100-word story to I think the longest fan fiction piece I've ever written is about 45,000 words.
Wow.
So.
But, and then you post those online, or is that mm-hmm. how you're distributing them? And
yeah,
there's sort of an audience that you've built up basically by these are other fans of this.
And in
story.
Fact, the audience is the interesting question, because the interesting effect of this sort of flying under the radar that we do is that very frequently the best work is the work that is most hidden. You know, when you have, there's a site called fanfiction.net, which is the sort of clearinghouse where you can post fanfiction on pretty much any fandom whatsoever. And honestly, everything there is, you know, 99% of it is just horrible dreck that you can't read because it's being written by 11-year-olds who are like, oh, I can write my Harry Potter story, you know, where I am a beautiful raven-haired elven princess who comes to Hogwarts and so forth. And the better the work is, the more likely it is to be hidden, to be protected from search engines, to be almost impossible to find. And
it's better because it's more hidden and better because they're doing a they're more hidden